Welcome to the Government Contracts Legal Roundup, a podcast focusing on important developments facing government contractors and grant recipients. This podcast is put on by the Jenner & Block Government Contracts Practice Group, and I'm your host, David Robbins. And oh boy, do we have some interesting ones for you today. Let's start with what I think is the biggest one of this period, CMMC 2.0 and the future of cybersecurity certification. DoD issued a significant proposed rule implementing CMMC 2.0, and comments are due by February 26th. Now, just stepping back a bit, in 2019, DoD first announced the CMMC program to move away from self-attestation of compliance with cybersecurity requirements applicable to the safeguarding of sensitive unclassified information, following an initial 2020 version implemented in an interim rule. Let's just call that CMMC 1.0, DoD announced a streamlined 2.0 in November 2021. Industry submitted 750 comments. Now look, in my government days, I had to respond to rulemaking comments. That's a lot. Now, just before the end of 2023, DoD issued a proposed rule implementing CMMC 2.0 with requirements set to take effect over a three-year period. So let's do a high-level summary, which is really hard to do in a short podcast, but we're going to do our best. The rule does not displace existing cybersecurity requirements for contractors, including FAR 52-204-21 and DFARS 204-70-12. Those clauses, when applicable, will continue to require contractors to meet certain cybersecurity requirements. The rule instead creates a certification regime whereby prime contractors and subcontractors may be subject to assessment by certified independent third-party organizations and required to pass those assessments as a condition of contract award. Footnote: boy, I hope we have enough of those certified independent third-party organizations to make this work, but that's a problem for another day. In other words, self-assessment of cybersecurity compliance will no longer be sufficient for thousands of contractors doing business with the DoD. DoD program managers will select which of the three CMMC levels are appropriate for inclusion in each solicitation. Level 1 aligns with the basic 15 security requirements at FAR 52-204-21. Level 2 aligns to the 110 requirements we all know from NIST Special Pub 800-171 Revision 2. And Level 3 is defined as the additional 24 select requirements from NIST Special Pub 800-172. While third-party assessments and certifications are a paradigm shift, the rule notes that contractors are already required to implement the primary substantive requirements and to perform, at a minimum, a self-assessment documenting compliance, which is submitted to DoD via the Supplier Performance Risk System, or SPRS. Notably, the rule does not mandate third-party assessments and certifications to achieve all three levels. Level 1 can be achieved through an annual self-assessment with results entered into SPRS, and a limited number of solicitations will also designate Level 2 as satisfied through a self-assessment. However, the majority of Level 2 certifications will only be achieved through a third-party assessor issuing a certification, and all Level 3 certifications will require that third-party assessor. Compliance is a prerequisite for doing business with DoD. This has been warned and hinted and flagged for us for years. The rule is clear that DoD does not provide mitigations for assessment delays that might prevent a contractor from obtaining the requisite certification prior to award of a contract. Prime contractors and subcontractors will need to be prepared to obtain certification for their systems well in advance of a competition. Even with a phased approach to implementation, it remains to be seen whether the CMMC ecosystem will provide adequate capacity to timely certify the many thousands of interested organizations within the defense industrial base. Or as I teased earlier, boy, I hope there are enough companies that can help you get through the process. Ensuring that subcontractors who receive CUI obtain Level 2 certifications may also present compliance challenges for prime contractors. However, the specific CMMC level required for a subcontractor is going to depend on the type of unclassified info the subcontractor receives. Thus, a subcontractor that only receives federal contract information will only be required to achieve Level 1 certification. So perhaps some small sliver of help or hope or something in this process. We will get there eventually. Everyone will get caught up eventually. We're all just a little bit worried about this interim while the assessments occur. The rule may widen enforcement and False Claims Act risk for contractors. For assessments at all three levels, a senior official from the prime contractor and any applicable subcontractor must annually affirm and enter into SPRS continuing compliance with the specified security requirements. Further, the DoD CMMC Program Management Office is responsible for investigating indications that a CMNC assessment is questionable, with consequences including revocation of certification. Obviously, significant industry interest and comments are expected, given that the last rule triggered 750 comments. There's also a new proposed rule on a different subject, harmonizing the FAR suspension debarment processes with the non-procurement common rule, the process followed in grants. First, the good. Pre-exclusion interactions like show cause notices and other informal engagements are recognized in the rule, which is a very important change given that this is where much of suspension debarment practice occurs these days, and it was wholly absent from the face of the rule previously. But of additional concern to contractors, state and local proceedings would qualify for affording due process under the proposed rule, even with their different standards and processes. So what does that mean? Federal debarments can rely on state decisions as evidence without any further work, and that's a bit of a challenge. There's also a broader definition of conviction to include deferred prosecution agreements that could give rise to debarments and limit due process. There are generally government-friendly edits in this proposed rule, with limited to no due process enhancements for respondents and no guidance on how individuals can demonstrate their present responsibility. But there is goodness from the contractor perspective mixed in here. Sticking with suspension debarment for a moment, additionally, the Interagency Suspension Debarment Committee, a committee I sat on during my government days, published its combined fiscal year 21 and 22 annual report. I know, annual report should be annual, should be current. That's not where we are. But this is delayed, and even if it's delayed, it still provides helpful guidance about the government community's near real-time practices. They're now just a fiscal year behind. So what do we learn? At the very highest level, pandemic relief fraud, federally funded research misconduct, and especially with respect to foreign affiliation in research and more broadly, that has drawn attention. I've got an expert analysis piece in Law 360 published last week. I'm happy to send that along for any who want to learn more about this topic. But something tells me the CMMC 2.0 is of much more interest. We've got a bid protest or two to cover, and then I promise we'll wind down because you're very patient with listening to all of this. I know it's a lot, but it's been a lot of fun this period, and we want to cover it all. BH Aircraft Company, Inc. versus United States, a Federal Circuit decision. This was a short per curiam opinion. The Federal Circuit affirmed the Court of Federal Claims' rejection of a protester's allegations of improper bundling, but avoided addressing thorny issues of standing. Here, BH Aircraft requested that the Navy unbundle the replacement of an aircraft part from the repair of that part. Navy refused, finding that not only was there not improper bundling, but BH Aircraft was not a qualified bidder for the replacement work in any event. BH Aircraft protested at the court. The court decision contained a complex discussion of the protester's standing, framed as an issue of subject matter jurisdiction that had to be addressed before the merits. Ultimately, BH Aircraft's complaint was dismissed for lack of standing on the ground that the company was not a qualified bidder. Alternatively, the court concluded that the protester failed to state a claim upon relief could be granted because BH Aircraft had not established a violation of the bundling regulation. In affirming the decision at the Federal Circuit, the panel explained, because the interested party requirement is no longer treated as a jurisdictional rule, it is no longer necessary to grapple with standing before rejecting a protester's claim on the merits. Federal Circuit thus did not reach the issue of bidder qualifications, but instead affirmed that the court correctly concluded that BH Aircraft's complaint failed to state a claim. BH Aircraft is a really helpful demonstration of the practical impact of the new framework for dealing with interested party issues. Moving to GAO, Consorti EX Inc., and I've said this before, but sometimes it's really hard to figure out how to pronounce these names when you only see them written, so we're going to go with that, and I apologize if I get it wrong. Here, GAO dismissed a protest challenging the award of a contract where the protester alleged that the PWS contained latent ambiguities regarding the level of effort necessary to perform the contract. The protester presumably felt compelled to raise this objection given the significant price disparity between the awardee's price at $1 million and the protester's price at $33.8 million. GAO said, as a threshold matter, for an ambiguity to exist, there must be two or more reasonable interpretations of the terms or specifications. GAO distinguished between an ambiguity susceptible to two or more reasonable interpretations and generally vague solicitation language that is not susceptible to a reasonable alternative interpretation. Here, because the protester could not establish that the PWS was anything other than vague, i.e., it was not susceptible to reasonable alternative interpretations, any protest challenging the vague solicitation terms was due prior to the deadline for proposal submission and thus untimely when filed post-award. This decision highlights a protest tactic used where vastly different approaches suggest that offerors had different understandings of the solicitation. But for this allegation to be viable, the protester must identify an actual solicitation ambiguity, language susceptible to two or more reasonable interpretations. A poorly written or vague solicitation will not suffice to lay the foundation for a cognizable protest award. I think that's enough. Let's close there. Thank you for joining us for the Government Contracts Legal Roundup. If you have any questions or need more information about anything here, I can be reached at 202-639-6040 or drobbins with two Bs at jenner.com. Thank you very much.